turn and face the strain. Changes. Don't wanna be a richer man.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. David Bowie was a shapeshifter, the first great shapeshifter of the modern pop era. More would follow. Madonna, Lady Gaga. But Bowie showed the way to break boundaries. He died Sunday night at 69, days after releasing his last album, Black Star, an artist to the end. This hour On Point, remembering the late, great David Bowie. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What did David Bowie say mean to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from London is Peter Doggett, music critic and historian, author of The Man Who Sold the World, David Bowie in the 1970s. His latest book is Electric Shock. Peter Doggett, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thanks very much. Pleased to be here.
And with me in the studio is Tim Riley, professor of journalism at Emerson College, music critic, author most recently of Lennon, Man, Myth, Music, also of Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. Tim Riley, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom.
And I'm sorry to both of you that it has to be David Bowie's death that brings us together. Peter Doggett, I think for most people, this was a huge shock. Was there advance warning of some kind that David Bowie's health was in so much trouble?
Not recently. I mean, it was a complete shock to me when I turned the BBC News on yesterday morning at 7 o'clock and got the grim tidings. It seemed particularly surreal in the wake of an album coming out 2 days beforehand as well. But I was reflecting yesterday that the irony was that when Bowie more or less retired about 10, 11 years ago from at least public performance and also from making new records, the music business in London was awash with rumours that he was dying, that he was having heart attacks, that he had cancer. And the rumours kept coming and kept coming to the point that eventually you think, well, if he was that ill, he would have died by now. And then we had the new album 3 years ago and then the other new one. And so him dying was the last thing on my mind, I have to confess.
Tim Riley, and then when the news does come out, it comes right along with this video, Lazarus, of a blindfolded, very gaunt Bowie on what looks like a deathbed, singing about his imminent end. He says, oh, I'll be free just like the bluebird. Oh, I'll be free. Ain't that just like me?
Yeah.
As though he knew very well and wanted us to know he knew and almost speak from beyond.
Well, that's what us critics are reeling from today, because we all got this record and a lot of us hadn't listened to it until we learned of his death.
Just came out. Was it Friday?
I think. Yeah. And that happened to be his 69th birthday. And the record called Black Star is a phenomenal piece of work. And it is very much concerned with mortality. And we get this very strong sense throughout the record, which is a very passionate record. It's a very odd record for David Bowie. It's not cold and distanced.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very direct. It's very driving. It's very fierce. And it is as though he knew he was dying and he was creating a record about death. And so you have this very chilling kind of feeling because, of course, we're very sad. Our thoughts go to his family and we hope he didn't suffer. And yet he created a masterpiece along the way, and we're busy. I can't wait to get back and listen to this record again. The record is Wowsville.
Let's listen to more. Here's the track Lazarus from the new album Black Star, released just Friday.
Look up here, I'm in heaven. I've got scars that can't be seen. I've got drama, can't be stolen. Everybody knows me now.
From the very latest album, Lazarus, David Bowie, 69, as that came out, Peter Doggett. I mean, we know he was the absolute master of what? Art theater around his work. Is it beyond imagining that Bowie foresaw his death and made this all part of a kind of gift, artistic presentation to his followers, his listeners?
It's very certainly a statement, isn't it? I mean, it's a very stark statement as well. You mentioned that my most recent book is Electric Shock, which is a bit just out in the UK, which is a big history of popular music.
Mm-hmm.
And in there, I actually talk about the fact that there's never been a great rock album about old age and death. And, you know, perhaps David Bowie has just delivered one.
Incredible. Do we know more about the cancer, what it was, how long he might have known, what sort of heads up David Bowie had?
I think I get the impression where the family said he'd known for 18 months. And one of the people that with whom he collaborated on the off-Broadway production, which is also called Lazarus, which opened in December, he has said that he was told by Bowie at the back end of 2014 that he had cancer. And I think it was liver cancer, but that hasn't been confirmed by the family.
I want to bring our listeners in right away, many responding to the death of David Bowie. Samantha in Columbia, South Carolina. Samantha, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to say that even though I'm 28 years old, David Bowie formed a lot of my identity, you know, and I don't think I realized until after he died that I had lost a really big part. Of course, everything he had done, he's done is going to be there, but there's no more to build on. And like I said, it wasn't until he died that really struck home with me. And I've taken it more personally than I have. I mean, you know, because Bo is a stranger to me, but, you know, taken it more personally than any other celebrity death. And so rest in peace, David Bowie, and thank you for all your music.
Samantha, thank you for calling. I mean, Tim Riley here. Samantha, she's 28 years old, not even beginning to be born when David Bowie began to make his impression on the world and
right.
still that kind of impact.
Oh, well, it's one of the unique aspects of his work is that it does kind of transcend time. I mean, he has this kind of dual capacity of being of the moment and being the superstar of the 70s, being so perfect for that decade, representing so many different ideas that were alive at the time, the alternative sexuality, the theme of aliens, all of that stuff. And yet, as that was happening, many, many critics were remarking, this is classic sounding. This is music that will transcend its time because his commitment to craft and his technique was so assured. And he said things with such confidence and such daring. So that doesn't surprise me that the younger generation has picked up on him. He's somebody who really can express himself through different time periods.
Even though his first big hits go all the way back, well, this, of course, the great, back to 1969, July 20th, the first broadcast in England during the BBC's coverage of the American moon landing, David Bowie's Space Oddity, or what he called the first anthem of the moon, about the launch of a fictional astronaut named Major Tom. It was Bowie's first UK top five hit.
This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door. Stars look very different today. For here am I sitting in a tin can.
Peter Doggett, who was David Bowie when he hit the charts in the UK? It would be some years before he really hit in the US, but what was his backdrop? He was older and more fully formed than some of the other big rock era artists that we knew so early.
Well, he was older in career terms because he'd been playing music professionally since 1962, 63. But at the point when Space Oddity was a hit, I think he was only 22 years old. So he was a very young man. He was actually younger than say, John Lennon or Paul McCartney when they broke
All
through.
All right. More experienced. What was his background?
He came from a poor South London house, which I don't think was full of culture. He came from a family that was scarred by the threat of mental illness. The story goes that when he was young, his mother said to him, "Oh, you're bound to go mad. All the people in our family go mad." And indeed, he had a stepbrother about 10 years older than him called Terry, who was a very, very important figure as David was growing up, who, very sad to say, had to be put into what we used to call an asylum then in 1970.
He was bipolar, I think.
Or possibly paranoid schizophrenic mm-hmm. anyway. Mm-hmm. And for David Bowie to have to be watching as this great sort of role model of his gradually became more and more removed from the real world, and to think that this might happen to him as well, I think had a huge impact on him. I think it gave him this desire to work. He was always doing something. He was always creating. If something didn't work, he'd do something else. And that was really the story of his 60s, was he was all the time jumping ship. One minute he would be a psychedelic rocker, the next he'd be almost like a vaudeville artist, and then he was a folk artist, and then almost out of the blue he ended up doing Space Oddity, which at the time was seen, it's a great record, obviously, but it was very much seen as being a kind of novelty, a cash-in on the Apollo moon missions. And then for a couple of years after that, he vanished again. So he almost seemed destined to go into history just for this one record.
Peter Doggett, please stand by there in London. It's great to have you with us. The man who sold the world, David Bowie, in the 1970s, Peter Doggett's book on David Bowie, who died Sunday after an 18-month struggle, we're told, with cancer. Tim Riley is with me in the studio, author of Hard Rain, Lennon, Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. David Bowie, no small part of that. Listeners, you can join us this hour. Were you shocked to hear that David Bowie has died? What is the song, the image of David Bowie that most sticks with you? Who, what was David Bowie to you? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I laughed and shook his hand and made my way back home. I searched for form and land. For years and years I roamed. I gazed a gazeless stare at all the millions here. We must have died alone a long, long time ago. Who knows? Not me. We never lost control. Your face to face with the man who sold the world.
Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Weird and Gilly and the Spiders from Mars.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great, now suddenly late, David Bowie, the superstar of changeability, champion of the other, the outsider, dead this week at 69. Behind us, Ziggy Stardust, 1972. You can join us this hour. Were you shocked to hear that David Bowie has died? And who, what was David Bowie to you? What was he chasing, showing us with Ziggy Stardust, Major Tom, his labyrinth persona, the man who fell to earth, all his changes? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Tim Riley joins me in the studio from Emerson College, author, rock culture expert, author of Hard Rain, Lennon, Fever, and more. Peter Doggett is with us from London, the man who sold the world, his book on David Bowie, his latest, Electric Shock. Jose is calling from Marietta, Georgia. Jose, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I discovered Bowie in my second year of college, right when the Ziggy album came out, and I was, like, dumbfounded. It was, like, so unpredictable, the music and the flow and everything about it. And I was, like, totally, like, what is this? Anyway, I worked my way back on his previous few albums, and everything was different from itself. I mean, it just constantly was sounding different. I said, oh, my God, this guy's not predictable at all. And then I said, is this glam rock? Is this the beginning of glam rock? Because I was reading those teen magazines and following his career. And he was battling it out with a guy named Mark Bolan and T-Rex. And T-Rex was huge at that time, too, bigger than Bowie was. But it was like a kind of a battle going on. And I said, wow, man, this is incredible, a new development of music. And I got to find other people that sound like Bowie. So I searched out the music bins and found one guy named Joe Bryant, who was a Bowie clone. But I listened to his record. It was like, it didn't go nowhere. It didn't have the magic that Bowie had. And that was the only guy I ever found that was kind of a Bowie clone. He was Joe Bryant. And, you know, I left him behind because he was nothing. And then T-Rex died. Mark Bolan died in a car accident, and Bowie owned it. It was his, you know, his music stood alone. Nobody else could touch it.
Jose, I appreciate your call. I mean, going all the way back to when the sort of birth of glam rock there. What was it, Tim, to your eye and ear about Bowie that put him, it did seem in a class of his own for a long time there, maybe always?
Well, you know, a lot of it was ambition and the idea that he felt like rock and roll could really expand and grow and say more and more things than previously anticipated. This is the one of the ways that he comes up for criticism too, is that he came across as an artist first who maybe was just kind of dabbling in rock and roll, right? Because he brought all this theatrical stuff to it, right? And so that's one of the reasons we talk about him as a postmodern rocker. And postmodern is a term that gets thrown around a lot. But you think about postmodernism as the frame becoming part of the subject. And he was definitely taking that idea of, okay, I'm going to dabble with all these different elements of rock and roll and rearrange it a bit. And he was definitely doing that. He was part of the glam rock thing. One of my favorite Lennon quotes is that Lennon called glam rock guitar rock with eyeliner.
Yeah.
But New York Dolls, very, very influenced by them. And, of course, Mott the Hoople. And one of the things that you heard about in the industry with Bowie was how generous he was. And there's a famous story about Mott the Hoople who had decided to break up. And one of the members calls Bowie and gives him this news. And Bowie says, oh, no, you can't break up. I love Mott the Hoople. You can't possibly. And he gives them a song called All the Young Dudes. And he produces
them.
The record and appears on the record with them. It's a huge, massive hit. He basically brings Mott the Hoople back from the dead because he's such a big fan.
Here's Bowie, 1973, talking with British television ITV's Russell Hardy Plus about his fans and his critics.
You split people down the middle, don't you, a lot? That is to say that people are hostile to you or they're totally indifferent.
Oh, absolutely.
To know about
yeah.
That. What kind of reaction do you get from the people who are violently in favour of you? I mean, do you get fan mail?
Yes, a lot.
What is it, scabrous or dangerous or interesting or exciting?
It's very sexy.
In what way?
I seem to draw a lot of fantasies out of people and a lot of fan mail I get.
David Bowie, 1973, and here, 1972, Starman.
There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He's told us not to blow it, because he knows it's all worthwhile. He told me, let the children lose it. Let the children.
Concept album, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust, that persona he took on. We would then come later to see Madonna take on a series of persona, Lady Gaga do the same, and others. David Bowie right out front on that. Peter Doggett, many saw him as a kind of just over-the-moon showman, but later, and certainly now in death, some are looking at him and saying, you know, it was a kind of revolutionary, the ambition Tim Riley talked about, more than just career ambition, a kind of ambition to show what the wider frontiers of human expression there. The Nation is out with an essay here in the U.S. talking about him as an apolitical insurrectionist who taught us how to rebel, Peter.
You see, I think all of those things are true, and that's the wonderful thing about Bowie, is that he encompasses so many different views of the world and so many different styles, because he was open to everything. I think the great lesson of David Bowie, well, there are two parts to it. The first part is be open to creativity, and he was always open to creativity, however it came. And the second, possibly even more important, is don't recognise boundaries. Don't let boundaries slow you down. And so, yes, he was into mainstream entertainment. He loved Judy Garland and Frank Sinatra. Yes, he was a glam rocker or glitter rocker or whatever. But he was an experimentalist in any medium he could find. He was excited by all of it. He always wanted to learn more, to experiment more. And really, what a fantastic example to all of us.
Here's Bowie in 1975, the BBC documentary Cracked Actor, talking about the importance of finding all those facets of one's personality within himself, maybe within others.
That's something I feel very strongly about, that one isn't totally what one has been conditioned to think one is. That there are many facets of the personality which a lot of us have trouble finding, and some of us do find too quickly.
Bob in Norfolk, Virginia. You're on, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Good day, Tom. Thank you for taking the call. I've been a musician for over 30 years now, and that's what I do. And whereas Bowie himself didn't so much influence me in his styles, he so impressed me in many generations of musicians. I'm in my mid-50s. And he, the way that he went from glam rock and pushed that, and then he went into rock and roll and then experimented with things and then into straight pop, always morphing, always kind of pushing an envelope that many people didn't even see, just gives people such an artistic license to expand and to grow. And his professional and artistic talent there was unbelievable to people on the periphery and in the business. And he was gracious, as I was going to bring up Motley Hoople as well. I've talked with Ian Hunter, and just the experiences that everybody says about, everybody brings up Bowie who has met Bowie, whether they were followers, disciples, or just people looking going, wow, look at Ziggy is now playing in a four-piece metal band in the late 80s and playing with Stevie Ray Vaughan in the early 80s and making him kind of out front. Just totally different than anybody of his generation. And so inspiring, even in death, that his latest album is just great. And like you said, nobody has touched this idea of, you know, I'm getting ready to go away. Harrison attempted it, I think, with his last thing. But Bowie really articulated his stages of life. You saw the depression, you saw the happiness, and you saw him going from phase to phase undaunted. And it was just so inspiring. And I'm just so glad that I was in his generation to see it, because it really is a great thing.
It really was pretty amazing to see. And here he was, this is all the way back in 2002, but talking about aging, of course, he wasn't that old then, in his 50s, but also about death. David Bowie with the BBC.
I don't have a problem with aging. In fact, I embrace that aspect of it, and am able to, and obviously am going to be able to, quite easily. It doesn't faze me at all, aging. It's the death part that's really a drag. You know? Everything else I can quite cope with.
Yes, and even the death, when it came, he managed to pull into his art. Peter Doggett, speak to how Bowie saw himself as like and unlike the other superstars of his generation there, the Stones or the Beatles or other really big ones. Did he see himself in a class of his own? What was the difference?
I think there was an air of amusement about Bowie, which always comes across in his interviews. I mean, I never had the privilege of meeting him, unfortunately, but friends of mine who did, they always say how warm and personable he was, and how he would tell you a story with complete conviction and then tell the next interviewer a completely different story, the opposite story, with equal conviction as well. He had a great sense of humour, and I don't think he ever took himself that seriously. And so, because he didn't ever really see himself as a rock star or an entertainer or whatever, I don't really think he thought he was competing against those people. He was up against everybody or nobody.
Badger in Nashville, Tennessee. Badger, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I fell in love with David Bowie back when I was 14, 44 years ago, after hearing, I think, his first American release, The Man Who Sold the World. And I was a closet case gay kid in a time when we still went to prison or state mental hospitals to be cured of our diseases. And I think David saved my life. I adopted his song, All the Mad Men Is Mine, and it saved me through high school. And I'm grieving right now. I think he was one of the greatest artists of all times. And the fact that he's gone, I still think he's immortal.
As a closeted young gay person, Badger, did you get a message from him that was comforting, that was affirming? What was it?
Oh, God. Yeah, like I said, it saved my life. It gave me hope that I might survive, and I did. And I saw him do his Glass Spider tour, and the only song that he played that was off the Glass Spider album was All the Mad Men. And I was standing off to the side of the stage, and it was like he was singing it just for me. And It was so beautiful. David was so beautiful and still is. And I'll be mourning for quite some time.
Bedja, I appreciate your call. Simon Critchley writing in the New York Times today saying, Bowie spoke most eloquently to the disaffected, to those who didn't feel right in their skin, the socially awkward, the alienated. He spoke to the weirdos, the freaks, the outsiders, and drew us into an extraordinary intimacy, although we knew this was a total fantasy. But it was also, Critchley writes, a love story. All the way back in 74, Bowie was on the Dick Cavett show. And Cavett talked with him about living as a, quote, gay man in America and England. Here was some of that exchange.
When you walk around New York and a hard hat says, hey, sweetheart, you know.
My driver you in have New York.
Good idea. What do your parents do for a living?
Well, my father's dead and my mother, I think she's got a day job.
Does she have trouble explaining you to the neighbors who say, are you any relation to that?
Oh, I think she pretends I'm not hers.
David Bowie, 1974. Peter Doggett, how did he see and handle, present his sexuality? How much of that was theater and how much of that was direct, honest presentation?
He was open to everything at the same time as having twice been married. And as we know, he ended up very happily married, as far as outsiders can see, for a long time. Mm-hmm. In very early 72, when he wasn't at all famous in the UK, he gave an interview to the magazine Melody Maker in which he said, I'm gay, at a time when probably most people in Britain didn't even know what that meant. And he traded very much on that sort of subversive, dangerous, bisexual sort of image for a year or two. And then he denied it. And then he said, oh, no, I was telling the truth the first time. But one thing is absolutely certain, which is that comment and the way he presented himself on stage in the 70s had such a huge inspiration, as we've just heard from your last caller. But I can only talk for England. Anybody who was gay or bisexual or uncertain about their gender or their sexuality, he was their hero. He was the one who stood up and gave them the opportunity to feel like part of the world.
I mean, Tim, you look at some of his songs, the big presentation back in the 70s of himself as an alien, and see that as almost as a metaphor for this boundary-pushing identity.
Well, I think it's one of his key themes and one of his key accomplishments is that he takes this idea, especially the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust. So he takes the idea of an alien coming to Earth, and that serves as a metaphor for people who feel alienated in their bodies, in the predominant sexual mores of the culture. And he was playful with it. So it gave them kind of permission to be, oh, yeah, I'm one of those. I'm like an alien. And I think it was a metaphor that was especially striking just for its time, because that's when we begin to step into outer space. And that's right as the alternative sexualities begin to become more public and more and demanding more civil rights. So it's the alignment of the planets around his career is really fairly startling. I mean, he's the perfect pop star for his time in a certain way.
Do you see that path from Bowie to Madonna to Lady Gaga? And
oh,
right,
absolutely.
On the shapeshifters?
In fact, you have to say when you do that, you have to say that he learned a lot from Bob Dylan. All right. So one of the overarching themes in rock and roll is identity formation, right? So mm-hmm. People trying on different costumes. So Bowie does this in just an outsized kind of form, and he does it in very different ways than Dylan did. But I think Bowie took the Dylan handbook and said, oh, I'm going to do this in a more theatrical way, where Dylan was doing it more stylistically.
It was a kind of cabaret feeling brought to everything.
No, he said he wanted to sort of combine Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht with rock and roll, right? And so he got into trouble with both sides. The theatrical people said, oh, he's just dabbling in rock and roll, or he's just dabbling in theater. And the rock and rollers would say, oh, he's just dabbling in rock and roll. He's a theatrical guy. He doesn't really know rock and roll. He's not really of rock and roll. And so that's where you come into criticism, because he had such an intellectual approach, right? So that left people feeling a little bit cold in certain places.
Behind us here, of course, Fame off the 1975 album Young American. The song, co-written with John Lennon, reached number one on the Billboard Hot 100. Bowie performed the song on Soul Train, one of the first white performers to play on that music variety show. Tim Riley with me in the studio. Peter Doggett in London, please stand by. We're talking about the great, now sadly, suddenly late, David Bowie. How will you remember this artist? 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
What
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour with the great, now sadly, suddenly late, David Bowie, the superstar of changeability, champion of the other, the outsider, dead this week at 69. Tim Riley is with us, author of Hard Rain, Lennon, Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America, all three. Peter Doggett, author of The Man Who Sold the World, about David Bowie. His latest is Electric Shock. You can join us this hour. Was this flamboyant pop star a pioneer all along? Did you see that? Did Bowie tell you it was okay, even cool, to be different? What do you want to keep from David Bowie? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. This, of course, Les Dance from 1983. Judy in Middletown, Rhode Island. Judy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think what was most striking for me about David Bowie is I discovered him when I was 14, starting high school, at the emergence of, you know, AIDS, at the emergence of the MTV generation, which was a very different Bowie from his first step out into musicianship. And what I discovered as I learned about him was he wasn't just every man's intellectual. He was also very human, very humanitarian, very compassionate. And this really has struck me about him throughout the decades as he's, you know, evolved and innovated, and other callers have spoken about that. But your one caller, Badger, referenced this. He was very, appealing to a lot of people because of his humanitarian. You know, I remember Live Aid when he led the public in the prayer of the Our Father, and I think it was in memory or of in recognition of Freddie Mercury's passing. And then, of course, during 9/11, he came out on stage and had a small piano. And through all of it, I think what was most striking is that he's a very human person. He's a very compassionate and gracious person. That was the deepest impression that he's had on me, and he will certainly be greatly missed.
Judy, I'll put it right to them, Judy, and I so appreciate your call. Tim, how do you square what you've several times called him cold in his performance? Judy's seeing compassion in his message. Is there a contradiction, or was Bowie somehow riding both of those?
Yeah, no, I think he's riding both of those, and that's part of his key accomplishment. You know, sometimes, I mean, he changed guises and wore different masks, and sometimes he seemed like he was a character straight out of Pirandello, you know, just introducing multiple characters in search of a plot or in search of an author. But there's a way in which the range of his work and his stylistic embrace and his sheer technique conveyed this humanism that she's talking about. It used style as a form of expressing substance, a different way of expressing it, rather than, you know, kind of like the opposite mode of Bruce Springsteen, who's very passionate, very emotional, very melodramatic, right? Mm-hmm. And Bowie would say, well, that in itself is a kind of artifice, and I'm using a different form of artifice to express humanism.
One of our listeners, Arp, writes online, says, given our culture's current obsession with identity and authenticity, I don't think Bowie could have been the same artist had he been born in the 80s or 90s. It's truly something else to be so ahead of your time that even when you die, the culture hasn't quite caught up with you. That is something to say. Peter Doggett in the UK, was he seen as a kind of intellectual boundary breaker? Was he seen as an intellectual in the performance world?
I think the intellectual side only came out later, really, when he was less obvious a pop star. I mean, he was a huge influence on everybody who came after him. I mean, the punks, the new romantics, every different new wave of British pop, really, from the late 70s onwards. They're all Bowie clones, but they're all clones of different bits of Bowie. So, I mean, the whole thing about identity with Bowie is really interesting, because I agree it would be much tougher for him coming along now to be as multifaceted. The other thing is...
why? Because the boundaries are all broken now, or would he just find new terrain?
They are broken, but at the same time, the marketplace demands that people sit in little boxes and stay there. They don't really like artists who change. And although Madonna and Lady Gaga do change, they're changing within a very narrow sort of spectrum. But the other thing to remember about Bowie is that I said at the top of the show that he'd been making music. His first record was 1964, and it was 5 years before he had a hit. Now, you're not allowed to do that in the music business these days. You either have a hit straight out of the box, or you're finished.
I wonder, even then, surely, Tim, there was pressure to, you know, have an image and stick with it. I mean, people did change. The Beatles changed as well, but was it so different? I mean, wasn't it brave even then to go from persona to persona?
Well, it was brave, and that was part of his talent, was to turn that persona to persona into kind of his theme. I mean, he was out of the box in one guise, and then very, very quickly he was Space Oddity. It's another curious aspect of his career was that his first album was so early, and he had sort of one foot in the British invasion. If that first album had broke, we would think of him as a British invasion arrival, right? A completely different generation of rock and roll. Mm-hmm. But because it took him longer, he really was kind of searching. And the business was very different, as Doggett is saying back then. The business really was all about let's invent a persona. Let's be wild and outrageous. And nowadays, we have a much more conservative kind of idea about things.
Born as David Jones, of course, that name taken by Davy Jones of the Monkees. He had to find another, and it was David Bowie. Keith in Russellville, Kentucky. Keith, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Well, first, dittos to everything, all the accolades everyone said up to this point. But I think I was like 16 or 17 when I first came in contact with Bowie through a Circus or Cream magazine article. Hadn't heard his music yet, and just the appearance was so captivating that I went out and bought Aladdin Sane, and then when I heard like Panic in Detroit and the Gene Genie, and then years later to see him appear on Saturday Night Live in the cross-dressing, singing TVC 1-5,
mm-hmm.
I knew that the world of music would never see its like again. And I was fortunate enough to be in London a couple of years ago at the Victoria and Albert Museum, where the exhibit of David Bowie, sponsored by Gucci, and it was just absolutely marvelous. And so, on one hand, I'm very sad at the hearing of the death of David Bowie, but my goodness, doesn't Shakespeare need somebody to knock around with in the afterlife? So,
there's a duo.
Thank you, your guest. Thanks to your guests for helping maintain and continue the legacy, and to that wonderful David, Flights of Angels, sing thee to thy rest.
That's good. That's good, Keith, and we appreciate your calling with it. Thank you very much for that. Here's let's listen to a little bit from 1977, Heroes. It's a product of his Berlin period, the second in a trilogy out of Berlin. And this song, of course, tells the story of two lovers who meet at the Berlin Wall and try hopelessly to find a way to be together. Heroes, 1977. Yesterday, the German Foreign Office tweeted, "Goodbye, David Bowie. You are now among heroes. Thank you for helping to bring down the wall." Katie in Somerville, Massachusetts. Katie, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a huge fan. Thank you. I'm a more massive fan of David Bowie. And I just wanted to say I love him. He taught me how to love music. I grew up, you know, I remember back in the mid-80s when MTV was starting, my friends would see his videos and I wouldn't, and they think I was weird for loving him. I saw him with Nine Inch Nails in 95 in Portland, Oregon when I was there, and I just wanted to say I love him. I feel like I want to shout it from the rooftops, but also comment on the fact that my mom was, we were discussing yesterday him, and she learned so much given Lazarus and Black Star reading about him, and I just think it's just a beautiful syzygy of some sort that he
has left us with this beautiful last works, and that so many people have become a new audience for him as he leaves us. And I just wanted to say I love him. And
Katie, we got it, and I appreciate your call. I'm sure many people share that feeling. Peter Duckett, what about the low times in his career? I mean, it wasn't always on the high beam, and deeper into the 80s, even early 90s, he was pretty far off the central screen.
Yes, he had that huge global commercial breakthrough with Let's Dance, and a lot of the hardcore fans were a bit disappointed. They thought he'd gone mainstream because he'd been quiet for a couple of years. He always looked like death through most of the 70s, it has to be said. And then he's back with Let's Dance, and he's got a new white suit, and he's got new teeth and new sort of hair. He looks like a character from Miami Vice. And he almost looked more alien then than he did when he was being an alien in the 70s. And I think he did lose his way. I mean, I think he accepted this, looking back on his own career. For much of the 80s, he lost his way because he wasn't sure whether he should be pursuing art or success. And when you're that successful, it's a tough drug to beat, I think. And I think it was only when he took another step back, he got married and started experimenting again, that he really found his muse again.
Iman, of course, the supermodel that Bowie ultimately married, and of course Bowie with a lot of influence on fashion himself, fashion change after change after change in the public eye. From that peak in 1983, here was Modern Love off Let's Dance. Modern Love, 1983. Stevie Ray Vaughan playing guitar on that track. Ray in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Ray, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I personally met David Bowie a couple times. First in Laurel Canyon Drive in Hollywood. He was in America then, looking at different artists and things. I was with a performance art troupe that Gabriel Roth had sponsored. What really impressed me about this man is that he was more concerned and really into what we were doing. He was such a gentleman. He had such an open mind. And, you know, it was just amazing. And then he, afterwards, we all hung out together, and he was saying how it's now time for performance art to be in the mainstream with music in a variety of different ways. You know, and it was just him being aware. And when he did the Glass Spider tour, that really opened up performance art in America. I don't care what anybody says. This man was amazing. Because of him, we have what we have. Also, I'm a cancer survivor twice, and so now with his latest release gives me hope and others that even to the end, you can still be a human being. And he was the personification of it all. Thank you, David Bowie.
Thank you, David Bowie, and thank you, Ray. No denying that. Let's listen to a little bit off of that last album just out days ago on his 69th birthday, Black Star, from the title track from Black Star.
Something happened on the day he died. The spirit rose a meter and stepped aside. Somebody else took his place and bravely cried. I'm a black star, I'm a black star. How many times does an angel fall? How many people lie instead of talking tall? He trod the sacred ground, he cried loud into the crowd.
I'm a black star, I'm not a gangster. I mean, that is so self-aware.
Oh, yeah. And you have to give props to the Danny McCaslin Quartet, and this really is kind of a jazz fusion record, so it's another step forward for David Bowie stylistically. And I have rarely gotten excited about jazz fusion, but this record I just think is just tremendous.
Peter Doggett, it's an unusual experience to listen to the work of an artist so aware of his impending mortality.
It is very much so. It's quite chilling. And it's also, as your last caller said, it's also exciting to know that he was creative to the end. I mean, the strange thing for me is that this great album, the new one, sounds like a step on our journey. And it's just very hard to think that we won't get to see what the next step would have been.
That video that shows him, Lazarus, that shows him retreating into an armoire, into the dark, closing the door, just unbelievable, chilling. For many, probably, final image of David Bowie.
What an amazing bit of performance art that is. That is just incredible.
You can't straddle or span a much bigger span than that as a mortal human. Wow. Peter Doggett, author of The Man Who Sold the World. Latest book is Electric Shock. With us today from London, thinking about David Bowie. Peter, thank you so much for your insight and time today.
Okay, thank you.
And Tim Riley, author of Hard Rain, of Lennon, The Man, The Myth, The Music, author of Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. Tim, thank you very much for coming in. Great to have you.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Go out with just a little more. Late, great, David Bowie. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. You can twist time. Strange fascination.
That time may change me.